When's the last time you looked up at the night sky and tried to imagine what it would be like to view the universe from another planet? How small would the Earth look from Mars or from Pluto? Or what could you see when you peer through the rings of Saturn to count its dozens of moons? These are the kinds of questions that Philip Plait has wondered about since he was a kid. It inspired him to become the astronomer, science author and speaker, and would-be space tourist that he is today. Philip draws upon the latest scientific research to take us vicariously into the outer regions of our solar system and beyond. His book is Under Alien Skies, A Sightseer's Guide to the Universe. He joins us now on Travel with Rick Steves from his home in Central Virginia to give us a realistic idea of what distant space travel could show us. Phil, thanks for joining us.
Oh, my pleasure. Thanks for having me on.
Boy, you know, I work with tour guides all the time, and you are like a tour guide to space. And your book, Under Alien Skies, A Sightseer's Guide to the Universe, it's like a guidebook, isn't it?
That was the idea, actually. I have a lot of people come up to me when I'm giving public talks or when I take my telescope out and show people things like the Moon and Saturn and Jupiter. And they ask, you know, what would these things look like if you were really there? Would they look different? And I thought, sometimes yes, sometimes no, but it's complicated and there's a lot going on there. And I thought, you know, this would make a pretty good book. And I thought it would be fun to do it in a semi-fictionalized way where I take you to these places and show you what it would be like if you were actually there.
But reading through it, it's like, yeah, I guess that is, to the best of anybody's ability, what it would be like. And we don't even think about that. I've thought of Saturn all my life, but I've never thought of looking through those rings. And you take us right there. So I want to go through the highlights of this itinerary that you've laid out in your book. But before we get into each particular stop, could you just give us a very quick astro tour guide survey of what this itinerary would be? How did you structure the book?
Well, some of it was easy. For example, we've been to the moon. People have been to the moon. And that's as far as we've gone. So at least there we have the accounts of the astronauts. So I knew I could use that and start off the book that way. And also the moon is fairly familiar. You can go out and see it. And so at least people have some sort of grasp on it. From there, Mars was the next obvious candidate because we've sent lots of probes there. Asteroids and comets we're learning a lot about. It turns out they're pretty interesting. Saturn, because Saturn, I mean, come on. And Pluto, because I thought, you know, Pluto, maybe it's not a planet, maybe it is, depending on what you think, but it's sitting at the edge of the solar system. And so you can look one way and see everything that we're familiar with to see our neighborhood. And then you turn the other way and you're looking out into interstellar space. And I thought, what a perfect way to divide the book at the halfway point. And then from there, we visit a red dwarf star, which is a tiny, faint star. There's one called TRAPPIST-1 that we know has seven planets at least. And it's an interesting system. And from there, a binary star, clusters of stars, inside a gas cloud where stars are forming. And then finally, at the end of the book, because, hey, it's the last place you'd ever really get a chance to visit, a black hole. And what would it be like to actually see them up close?
You know, I get to talk to so many people who are so enthusiastic about what they do, and they're really wonks. You know, they're really into Botticelli, or they're really into opera, or they're really into ancient history or prehistoric caves. And I had a hunch you would be the great wonk for the solar system, and I can tell by your enthusiasm.
I'm going to put that on my resume, a solar system wonk. I like that.
Solar system wonk. Let's start with the moon.
That's
one place where conceivably we could actually, you know, a young person today may live to a day when you could be a tourist on the moon, I suppose. Do you think that's possible?
Sure. We are going back to the moon right now. NASA has a program to go back to the moon with international partners. And if that works, it's possible that space tourism will become a thing.
Now, you mentioned in the book that the temperature ranges from minus 200 to plus 250 or something like that. That's a 400-degree range. I don't even know what that's like, that cold and that hot. But there is a little window when it's actually, you know, in the 70s.
Yeah, but there's no atmosphere, which is a problem there. Temperature, I go into that a little bit because temperature is a funny topic. And yeah, the rocks on the surface of the moon can get very hot in full sunlight. And then at night, they cool off quite a bit. But it doesn't really work that way for us. You know, if you're out there exposed to the sunlight, it wouldn't be any different than being on Earth because the sun is the same distance from the moon as it is here. So sure, the rocks have this huge temperature swing, but without an atmosphere there, you'd be in a spacesuit or you'd be on a base or something like that. You wouldn't experience the temperature swings quite that substantially.
But what would you see from the moon looking at the Earth? Would it just be like being on the Earth looking at the moon?
A little, in that you have this big circular thing in your sky, but in fact, the Earth is 4 times wider than the moon. So if you were to stand on the moon looking at the Earth will look 4 times bigger than the moon does from Earth. So you'd be able to see colors, the continents, clouds. Be a little fuzzy. With binoculars, it would be spectacular. And you could watch the weather change. And the Earth would go through phases as well, just like the moon does from Earth. So you would see sometimes a crescent Earth, a half Earth, a full Earth, if you just wait long enough and watch it.
Would you see an Earth rise like we can see a moon rise?
That was a fun part of the book to write, let me tell you, because we're always told that the moon spins at exactly the same rate it goes around the Earth. And therefore, it always shows us the same face. And therefore, if you were standing on the moon, the Earth would always be in one part of the sky.
Huh.
But it turns out it's not that simple. The moon's orbit's elliptical and it's tilted and we see a little bit more than half of the moon. And from the moon, the Earth would, in fact, move around the sky. And so if you were at just the right part, like on the edge of the moon from where we see it from Earth, yeah, you could actually watch the Earth rise and set, but it would take several days for it to do it.
Wow.
Because the moon takes a month to go around the Earth, and that's what's actually governing what we see of the Earth from the moon.
Astronomer Philip Plait is taking us on a rip-roaring tour of the cosmos right now on Travel with Rick Steves. Phil's latest book, Under Alien Skies, is like a tour guide of our universe, where something new is always waiting to be discovered. Phil also writes on celestial and terrestrial topics for Scientific American and hosts a TED Talk on how to defend Earth from asteroids. He's also had a number of postings at scifiwire.com. We provide links to Philip Plait's work with this week's show at ricksteves.com/radio. Phil, the moon, been there, done that. Now take me to Mars.
Mars is a cool place to go because it's got some Earth-like features. There's land, there's an atmosphere. It's farther away from the sun, so it's colder and the sun would be smaller in the sky. But it gets pretty different pretty quickly because the atmosphere there is extremely thin. It's the same thickness as the Earth's atmosphere at about 3 times the height of Mount Everest. So you cannot breathe it. And even if you could breathe it, it's carbon dioxide. So it's there.
So it's like, but I got good news and bad news.
Yes.
There is an atmosphere.
And bad news, and then more bad news, and then, oh, by the way, you're going to die without a spacesuit on Mars. So that's the really bad news. But the atmosphere is enough to create weather, and there's dust on Mars that's actually made of iron oxide, rust, and it gets suspended in the atmosphere by winds, and it makes the air look kind of butterscotch-colored. And there can be huge dust storms and all kinds of things, clouds even on Mars. And this is all stuff that we've been learning recently because we have sent probes there.
And in your book, Under Alien Skies, you wrote about there's even like a Martian Grand Canyon. There's even, you know, natural wonders that we know about on the surface of Mars that you could conceivably have on your little bucket list when you were going to go visit Mars.
Absolutely. Valles Marineris, discovered by the Mariner probes when they flew past Mars. You're talking about a canyon so large that if you put the Grand Canyon next to it, it would be lost. This is an immensely long feature. It's roughly as in length as long as the United States. And there are volcanoes on Mars that are immense. Olympus Mons is the largest known volcano in the solar system. And it's roughly the size of, you know, a state like Nebraska. It's hundreds of miles across. And so these are immense features that you could actually see. They'd be better seen from orbit because then you get a grasp of them. But if you were to go there and stand there and look at them, some of them would be so big. You know, if you were on the caldera of Olympus Mons, you'd hardly even know it's a volcano. It's so big. But the valley would be incredible to see and walk around it.
Phil, we're leaving Mars now, and you call asteroids the vermin of the sky. I mean, there's like countless asteroids, and they're all in orbit just like planets, but they're different. What would you share as a tour guide about asteroids?
Well, they're called vermin of the sky because they used to leave streaks in astronomers' images when they were trying to take pictures of galaxies, and they would shake their fists at these asteroids getting in the way. But it turns out these are really interesting objects. The biggest ones are hundreds of miles across, and so they're almost like planets. And the smallest ones, I mean, there's no definition of what the smallest asteroid could be, you know, size of a basketball. And some of them are made of rock. Some of them are have a lot of carbon in them. Some of them are metal. And so these things have a lot of diversity to them. And a lot of them aren't even solid. The smaller ones that we've visited, like Bennu and Ryugu, these small asteroids that are less than a mile across, they're rubble piles. They're like basically sacks of rocks held together by their own gravity. And if you were to try to stand on one, they are so fragile, you could literally fall through the surface. It would be like jumping into a box of packing peanuts or styrofoam. You would fall right in. So actually visiting an asteroid is a little bit tough.
And you said in your book, you said billions of them. But yeah, if it's down as little as a basketball, even a small one can be in orbit, right? There's not a size limit to what it takes to be in orbit around the sun.
No, a speck of dust can orbit the sun. That's not the issue. It's how massive the sun is, really, to be in orbit around it. But as far as asteroids go, there are a billion of them larger than 100 yards across. So picture a football field. Imagine a giant rock sitting there the same size. There are a billion of those in our solar system, at least. So, and they're more, the smaller they are, the more there are.
Phil, all it would take is one of those billion giant rocks to crash into Earth, and it would have an impact. Do you worry much about asteroids crashing into Earth like we see on movies?
I don't fret about it. I don't lie awake at night in a cold sweat thinking we're going to get hit by an asteroid. On the other hand, it's a real thing, and they do hit us. You could ask a dinosaur about that, except you can't because they're all dead because an asteroid hit the Earth 66 million years ago.
And you so are my like kind that, of tour guide. Whoa.
And actually, you've probably been to see cenotes in Mexico, have you not?
Yeah.
Those were created, a lot things. Of those were created by cracks in the ground after the giant asteroid impact 66 million years ago. So there are places on Earth where you can go and visit the remnants of asteroid impacts.
Well, now, you know, just recently in the news, it was a big deal. We bombed an asteroid just to see if we could divert its course. That was quite an undertaking. Did we prove that we could protect ourselves from an asteroid that somehow scientists knew was heading for Earth and we could just alter its trajectory enough to save humankind?
Yes, actually, what you just said is basically correct. The asteroid Dimorphos comes close to the Earth. It has a little moon called Didymos and a probe called DART, the double asteroid
Wait a minute.
Redirection
you know,
test.
You know the you not only know the asteroid's name, you know its moon's name.
Oh, well, the moon is what we hit.
Oh.
And you know what? I said that backwards. Didymos is the asteroid. Dimorphos is the moon. And this double asteroid redirection test, the DART mission, slammed into that moon. And that's really hard. That thing was moving really fast. And it hit an asteroid that was only a couple of hundred yards across.
Whoa.
So that is
That's way
smaller than a bullseye.
That is darn good. And that could save our hides.
Yeah, it worked. The moon's orbit shifted. We knew how much and measured it. And we know that if it comes, we may be able to do this to an asteroid if it's threatening the Earth.
This is Travel with Rick Steves. We're speaking with Philip Plate, and he's written a book called Under Alien Skies, A Sightseer's Guide to the Universe. Phil writes for Scientific American. He's written three books, all of them space-related, of course. To learn more about his work, you can go to badastronomy.substack.com. So, Phil, I understand from your book that you just love Saturn. What is it about Saturn?
What isn't it about Saturn? If you've seen photos of it, right? It's gorgeous. It's this gas giant planet, almost 10 times wider than Earth. It's surrounded by these incredible rings, these immense rings that are so wide from end to end, they would stretch 2/3 of the way from the Earth to the moon. It's got a retinue of moons around it, and each one is weirder than the next. And it's also, you see these beautiful images of it from telescopes, from space probes that have been there. But at the eyepiece, if you've ever seen it through a telescope, it's absolutely beautiful. You don't get the detail you do in these pictures, but you can see those rings. And it's just spectacular. And a lot of astronomers, myself included, say that it was seeing Saturn as a kid that made them want to be an astronomer.
Now, what was really interesting that I picked up from reading your chapter on Saturn is it is less dense than water. As you put it in a very clever way, if you had a bathtub big enough to put Saturn in, Saturn would float.
Ah, but it would leave a ring.
It would leave a
very,
ring.
Very old, silly astronomy joke.
Astronomy joke.
We talk about the density of objects as how much stuff is packed into how big of a space. And so iron, for example, is very dense, and water is less dense, and air is less dense than that. So planets like Jupiter and Saturn, we call them gas giants, they're very low density. They have about the density of water. Earth is 5.5 times denser than water. It would sink if you could put it in a bathtub. But Saturn, in fact, is lower density than water, and it would float if you could get a bathtub that big.
Okay, now on our itinerary for the solar system, we've only got like a million years, so we have to pick and choose. And your next stop is Pluto, way on the far end of the solar system. Pluto, it's not even certainly a planet, right? I mean, there's some debate as if it's a planet or not.
Well, it's its own thing. It's doing whatever it's doing, no matter what we call it. And trying to define a planet, I think, is really tough. But the point, I don't worry about if it's a planet or not. The point is, it's an interesting object. It's rocky, it's icy, it's very cold. It's got 5 moons. This thing is small. It's much smaller than Earth's moon. And it's amazing that we can see it at all when it's 3 billion miles away. And so a space probe called New Horizons flew past it and took a lot of images of it up close for just a few hours. And we learned more about Pluto, I think, in those few hours than we did in the almost 100 years since it was discovered. And it's a weird, weird place.
Pluto. So fascinating. So just briefly, Phil, is the difference between an asteroid and a planet just an arbitrary size limit? I mean, asteroids are kind of like tiny planets, and Pluto is somewhere in the middle.
We don't really have a strict definition of what an asteroid and a planet are. You could have an asteroid that gets bigger and bigger and bigger, and then it kind of becomes a planet. We kind of think of asteroids as being rubble left over from the formation of a solar system. Planets are bigger, and Pluto, somewhere in between.
Well, Pluto is our springboard for the great outdoors when it comes to space exploration, I guess. And that's the rest of your book, but we don't have time for that. But I'm just so inspired to be able to be on your little tour bus as we dip into the solar system. Phil Plait, thank you for writing your book, Under Alien Skies. It is indeed a sightseer's guide to the universe. I guess I can say happy travels, even in your dimension.
Thank you very much.
Welcome to the New World Travels. You're longing for relaxation, excitement, adventure?
You can subscribe to Philip Plait's frequent newsletter postings at badastronomy.substack.com. In the wintertime, there are parts of Arctic Alaska, above the tree line, where the terrain and temperatures might make you feel like you're on another planet. But go to Alaska's big city of Anchorage along the waters of Cook Inlet, and wintertime is a season to celebrate getting out of doors. Up next, a longtime Anchorage resident who writes guidebooks to Alaska tells us how visitors to Anchorage can join in the area's wintertime fun, especially if you bring a warm coat and a decent pair of waterproof hiking boots. It's Travel with Rick Steves.